This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of March 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The changes around 12th and Chacon Street and what happened to two guys who left and came back.
You know, tripped me out. I caught a white woman walking down 12th Street at 3 o'clock in the morning, even though what am I doing at 3 in the morning? And I was like, I've never seen this.
How new development in the neighborhood is forcing some churches to close their doors.
Hopefully it will sell and we can relocate.
And the North Texas company buying up property along East 12th.
He told me not even listed. He'd just pay me whatever I wanted for it.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. And if you would leave us a nice review in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store, that would be awesome. If you have any questions, you can shoot me an email, nathan@kut.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUTNathan. Now, the intersection of 12th and Chacon in East Austin has a long history, but like many areas of Austin, particularly east of I-35, it's been undergoing some major changes in recent years, largely driven by rising property values. More people have been moving into the neighborhood. That's been pushing a lot of people out of the neighborhood. So we wanted to get a better understanding of what's going on and hear from the voices of the people who've lived there for years and years and generations in some cases. KUT opened a bureau at 12th and Chacon and spent the last 6 months reporting stories there. You can read all of them at onmyblockatx.org. If you're a loyal listener of this podcast, you'll remember we did an episode several months ago where we had a lot of those stories. We're going to kind of do the same thing this time. We capped off our reporting project this week with a live broadcast from 12th and Chacon. We broadcast Morning Edition from there, and we invited people in to have a community conversation, talk about a lot of these issues. So I want to play for you some of the fresh reporting we've done, but I want to start by listening back to some of the voices we've heard over the past 6 months on this project.
University of Texas undergraduate school just integrated, so you are pressing, everybody's pressing for that. But then in the nightclub scene, and these, of course, different folks, but you get an integration in the opposite direction, and it's kind of messing up your space. You know, it's a difficult time to maneuver through, you know, for a lot of people because they don't know exactly what shape to get in. You know, am I supposed to be for this? This is not working for me in this case of this nightclub, you know.
This is the only open club when a whole block was dead. This place always was open, so half of the black community, well, a whole black community actually sat in the same backyard where we sitting at right now and play dominoes, and they just be here all day, and this was their spot. But as I moved in and life moved in and the community changed, I probably see 50 people a week and come and be like, hey man, what happened to Club 40? You know, be like, man, I've been having this place 2 years. Well, where the people at? Man, I don't know.
The high school here was the catalyst. Now, catalyst is a bonding agent. When you put all the chemicals together, there's one particular chemical that bonds all the molecules and control and everything. That's what this school was. It was a bonding agent for the community. Now, think about, like I said, in chemistry, you don't have a catalyst, then everything just doesn't work. And that's what the school was. It was more than just a school.
Sense of place and trying to find a sense of home in Austin and in Travis County has always been such a struggle for African Americans here because it seems like once you put down roots, you have to move.
It's pretty ironic that in the early 1900s, you tell me where to live. Now I feel like they're telling me I can't go anywhere else because they won't allow me to sell my house for its actual value. Or let me say they made me jump through hoops to sell my house, which also cut me out of couple of bucks that I could have used or that I should have been entitled to.
We're definitely concerned as far as just watching the changes happening in this neighborhood, not just this 12th and Chacon, but the neighborhood as a whole, is the rent prices and really being concerned about being able to continue to provide affordable integrative medicine to everybody who needs it when we're kind of looking down the barrel at our own rent going up at our next lease cycle.
You're in your jogging shoes and your yoga pants walking up 12th Street, man. Are you kidding me? You know, no. You know, I hate is a strong word, but I don't want you to like me. I don't like you. There's nothing you can tell me about yourself, that you're cool, that you're an artist, that you're poor. Not even being a poor white person is good enough, you know?
If you think I'm playing, baby, things ain't like they seem.
I mean, yeah, he represents the change by us, like, by us working together, you know what I mean? It's like a change to show that, you know, black and white can get along, you know, but like I say, you know, I ain't never had better prejudice bone in my body, so, you know, you get along with me, I get along with you, you know, that's just me.
You better shake yourself and wake up, little girl. I swear you're just having a real bad dream.
Some of the voices we've heard reporting on the neighborhood around 12th and Chaco. Now, a lot of people have left that neighborhood, some by choice, others not by choice. So let's start with this story by KUT's Mose Bushell about what happens if you come back after a long and mandatory absence.
This is a story about two guys and how a neighborhood shaped their lives.
Testing. This is the first time I've ever used this mic, so you gotta forgive me.
It's all right. Get it together.
This is Andreas Mueller.
I can honestly say this is the first time I've ever been recorded.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Openly recorded.
And this is Matthew Malcolm Kleiman.
I'm born in Brackenridge Hospital in 1979.
They grew up together on the East Side. Tell me a little bit about your family.
Both my parents are radical activists, hippies.
And my mother knew his mother from going to UT from the 70s.
So what's a good soundtrack for their childhood?
I'm told by my parents the first record I ever heard was Jimi Hendrix Experience.
This is how they remember it.
Man, we were just little kids running around the neighborhood. If we seen a trampoline in your backyard, we would come knock on your door, ask you, can we jump on the trampoline?
It was a family atmosphere. Old people used to sit on their porches and watch us and yelling at us, you know, while we were running through their yards, get off my grass.
There were hard parts too. Money was tight. Andreas's mom was sick with lupus. He started caring for her, even driving her around when he was just a kid. Matthew's parents often weren't around, so they say the neighborhood helped raise them. This is how Matt describes the East Side back in the 80s.
We were not poor. We were working class people. We were proud working class people. We were people that had everything in our communities and our neighborhoods that we needed. We had mom and pop grocery stores, Roy Lee's on Manor Road, okay? Guess what? Black owned, mom and pop. They were all over the East Side. With a thousand smiles. You know, we never felt welcome on West Austin, which is why we didn't go there. But, we were always at home on the East Side.
I think a lot of people that listen to whatever story comes out of this will probably imagine that you're a black guy.
Maybe.
Here I'm talking to Matt.
A lot of people have thought that my entire life, though, especially just hearing my voice.
It wasn't Matt. That's white boy Matt.
That's my name.
White boy Matt.
Yeah.
My oldest son, whenever he was about 2 or 3, called him white boy Matt. We all snapped on him. You don't get to call him white boy Matt. You only call him Matt or Uncle Matt.
But I think at that time, that's something that brought us together, too. Yeah. I have to say, like, you know, both of us, for different reasons, weren't really even accepted in our own communities.
Matthew, because he was a white guy who identified with black culture. Andreas, because he was mixed race. His dad is African American. His mom, a white East German immigrant.
Came over here by herself and was never married and ended up having, you know, a mixed child and, you know, an immigrant with a minority child, you know, growing up in Texas, you know, was something different. That might have been one of our early
we're
bonding
always
points,
outcasts.
Not ever knowing it.
And a lot of our other friends were outcasts in different ways, too, you know.
Things got harder, as they usually do, when the guys became teenagers. But it was more than just the usual challenges. Andreas's mom got sicker. Matt's parents divorced. This was in the early 90s, and they say the neighborhood was changing, too.
gangs and violence kind of started to have this place in East Austin, and it came into my life.
Now here, they want to be careful. On one hand, they feel like the East Side got a bad rap when it came to crime.
Don't let it be said that, we were like the normal.
The whole East Side sound like, not at all. No, because it was families over there.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't crack houses on every block.
Yeah.
It was families over there.
But on the other hand, they say drug dealing became part of their reality.
What's this?
This is Criminal Element, man. This is
Texas music, Houston.
Yeah, Texas music. But I mean, a lot of this music we used to listen to reflected of what we were in, our environment was. You know, you relate to what you see, what you live.
So here's what they saw. Crack hits the street in the 80s. Police, who seem to turn a blind eye to drug use in white communities, start focusing on drug enforcement on the East Side.
You know, there's lawyers that live on the West Side that snort up tons of cocaine, you know what I mean?
They think some of that law enforcement created more chaos than it prevented. Older men were incarcerated. Boys like Matthew and Andreas started taking their place.
That was the best thing you could give me, knowing that my mom's finna die. Your best info that you can give me that I can take with me all 50 states in America to cook crack, and I can get paid regardless what slum where I live at. So that was the teachings of survival.
Eventually, both friends did time in prison. When Andreas got out in the early 2000s, he could hardly recognize the East Austin he returned to. Rents were up, a lot of the old businesses were gone, and there were a lot more white people around.
You know, something I seen when I first got out of prison was, you know, tripped me out. I caught a white woman walking down 12th Street at 3 o'clock in the morning, even though what am I doing at 3 in the morning? And I was like, I've never seen this. And the entire time, I'm 23, finna be 24 years old, and I've never seen this.
Matt noticed it too.
You're in your jogging shoes and your yoga pants walking up 12th Street, man. Are you kidding me?
But for him, it played a little differently.
Now, when I go to the East Side, I'm just that white guy on the East Side. Yeah, you're just that white guy that came into my neighborhood that bought a house here.
A lot of the old neighbors were gone too, and Andreas's mom had passed away. He was in prison and couldn't keep up on tax payments for her house. So when he got out, he lost that too. And that was over 10 years ago. But Andreas stayed in town, and Matthew did too. They just ended up moving to a different part of it. It was a complete coincidence, but now they live just a few blocks away from each other, down the street from a local school on the South Side. Andreas has a wife and kids. When he's not working, he volunteers coaching youth sports.
I want to give back because I know how easy it is to get in trouble and not get out.
Matt says he's focused on self-improvement, not drinking, not smoking.
I'm boring, man. Okay. You know, I'm a trades person. I just work with my hands, you know, carpentry, masonry. I like to do some music and stuff for fun. I walk my dogs. That's about the most you're going
to
catch me.
Yeah, he walks his dogs to my practices.
Yeah.
When they get together, they talk about the old neighborhood. They say it won't go back to the way they remember it as kids.
The East Side is not going to ever be the East Side again, and it's because people don't want the East Side.
And they wonder if the crime they got caught up in somehow ended up contributing to the gentrification that came after.
That violence created this excuse, I think, to say, we have to go into this community and we have to fix it for them. But they were coming from an outside position.
What really could fix it? They say it all comes down to money. Loans for family-owned businesses, wages that keep up with the cost of living, and funding for improved public schools. For Andreas and Matthew, these solutions seem obvious. They just don't seem to get done. So the two friends focus on building a new community in a different part of town. Moses Bouchel, KET News.
At the beginning of our series back in October, we told the story of Anderson High School that we had in the podcast back then. Anderson was a beacon of the black community in East Austin until it was forced to close in 1971. This was part of desegregation. But Anderson was not the only neighborhood school to close. Keeling Junior High School also closed. It reopened in the 1980s, though, as a neighborhood school with a magnet program. But the tensions of the past still linger in the school's hallways. KUT's Kate McGee reports the new principal there is trying to correct some of those mistakes of the past.
Kenesha Coburn stands in the middle of the hallway in Keeling Middle School. Some students run by her. Coburn stops them, makes them go back to where they started, and walk.
They don't make eye contact with me when they're sprinting. They're like, she didn't see me, she didn't.
Coburn is in her second year as principal of Keeling Middle School, but she knows many of the students by name and jokes with them.
Hey, Brayshawn, hey, Glasgow. Y'all look tired. Food coma?
Keeling has two programs in the cafeteria, the Magnet Program, which accepts students from across the district, and the neighborhood school known as the Academy Program. One of the first things Coburn noticed was the racial division. Most of the students in the Magnet Program are white or Asian, and most of the students in the Academy Program are black or brown.
When you have an advanced academic program, and the perception is that it only welcomes white and Asian students, then the message, intentional or not, to black and brown kids is, if that's what it looks like to be advanced academic, then obviously kids like me aren't.
The school is academically successful, but that success isn't equal among students. Nearly all white students pass the state standardized tests. Those numbers are much lower for African American and Hispanic students. But Coburn says that achievement gap doesn't mean black and brown students are intellectually inferior. Many of them bring issues to school that makes it more difficult to learn.
I have students who the data that you see on paper for them is a function of mental health issues, family challenges that you can't learn yet because there are these big things that you're dealing with that are getting in the way.
Coburn says the racial divide in the school today is also a reminder of Keeling's history. The mostly black school was closed in the 1970s because of forced desegregation.
You had to leave your community and go across town, and your school's name went. Like, there's a whole lot of just nasty, deep, deep history of loss, whether or not it was intended to be that way. That's the feeling.
A lot of her job is figuring out ways to get underrepresented students to realize their potential and open doors to success.
And then once you start opening them and you see students or families not walk through, you realize that it's no longer just about the door being open, but the history being so pervasive that I don't feel like I'm going to be comfortable when I walk in, so I'm not going to.
Coburn says she often pushes students into uncomfortable situations like harder classes, after-school clubs, or sports. This year, Keeling also changed its magnet admissions process, so half of the students are accepted based on their zip code.
We've always said we want all kids, but we also operated an admission system that didn't necessarily recognize kids from all over the city.
Now, both magnet and academy students can take the same elective classes, and they have advisory period together. Coburn also implemented training for teachers about microaggressions. Many of the changes are driven by teachers, who she says took it upon themselves to examine the school's history and suggest changes to improve the school for all students.
Our teachers are much more capable of and ready to collaborate across all of the lines that we have drawn in the sand. They didn't draw them. They've been drawn by other people and they've been forced to live within them.
Now, teachers can teach classes in the Magnet Program and the Academy Program too. Next fall, Coburn expects the new sixth grade class in the Magnet Program to look a lot more diverse. She hopes that visible change will be the start of a new chapter in Keeling's history. Kate McGee, KUT News.
Churches have long been a mainstay in East Austin. Many of those houses of worship have roots going back more than a century. But new development has been rolling through the neighborhood, and that has forced some churches to close their doors and relocate. KUT Saida Hassan reports on how some congregations have adapted.
In a few minutes, Pastor Clarence Jones has a meeting with a potential buyer.
So if you notice this, you're coming in, you saw the for sale sign.
He's been having a lot of these meetings over the past 2 years, ever since church leaders decided to put the Greater St. John Baptist Church up for sale.
Hopefully it will sell and we can relocate. So that's what we're looking forward to at this time.
The decision to sell didn't come lightly. Jones says the church has been here at the corner of Greenwood and Pennsylvania Avenues since 1945. But lately, he says the neighborhood feels more crowded.
We would love to have been able to stay here, but as you look around, there's not any land to use as parking or else to build a larger church on.
Just across Pennsylvania Avenue, there's a new house being built. Another bright blue two-story home is for lease right across Greenwood. As more people move in, Jones says parking for church events has become scarce. They're considering new locations outside the city limits in Manor.
We felt that that would be a good place to relocate. Lots of people moving in, and right now the land is not quite expensive as it is here in Austin.
In fact, Jones's own family recently left Austin for Manor, as has much of his congregation. His wife, Brenda Jones, says when she was growing up, the neighborhood around the church was predominantly African American. She says, in a sense, the new diversity is a good thing, and the church is open to everyone, but she hasn't felt welcomed by new residents.
They don't want us to have the loud music, the worshiping hours, so it's time that we should move. So it's really about the time, you know what I mean? It's time for the church to spread our wings.
A couple miles east, another church has already made the move.
I think the people were just so happy, number one, to be in a larger space.
Renette Bledsoe is the senior warden at the St. James Episcopal Church. A few years ago, the church left its old home on MLK and moved to a spacious new facility on Weberville Road. Bledsoe says they made it a point to stay in East Austin.
That's just simply the historical foundation of this church. And sure, the church could have moved someplace else, but that is not what the people wanted.
Bledsoe says the church follows a philosophy of, quote, radical hospitality, making a point to include people of all ages, ethnicities, and sexual orientations. St. James was originally founded in 1941 as a space for African Americans, who at the time weren't welcome at Austin's white Episcopal churches. Bledsoe says members actively recruited a more diverse congregation.
People made an effort to go out and invite others to come and to worship. People that may not have looked like them, to invite them to come in and to worship, and then more people invited people to come in.
Today, St. James hosts a weekly service in Spanish. Bledsoe says some members commute from as far away as Burnet or Taylor to come worship. Still, some say the loss of nearby residents makes it hard for East Austin churches to hold on to their roots.
It's a huge blow to the community.
Nefertiti Jackman is the executive director of Six Square, a nonprofit that works to preserve and celebrate African American heritage in Central East Austin. The group's office sits down the street from a Methodist church on San Bernard Street. Jackman says on Sunday mornings, the neighborhood is transformed.
There's cars parked everywhere. There's a vibrancy with people coming and going as they're worshiping, but you don't see that during the week, and it's really unfortunate.
Jackman says she hopes to see creative uses for churches that are struggling to retain membership, uses that would keep them active throughout the week. She's hopeful about a new city program that would allow for houses of worship to rent out spaces to artists as a source of revenue.
And I've long thought about that. How can we partner churches with other nonprofit organizations looking for space? And the churches need the revenue. Many of them need the revenue because they don't have the large congregations anymore.
Back at the Greater St. John Baptist Church, Pastor Jones says he hasn't given much thought to what might happen to the property once it's sold.
We really just want to get as much as we can for the property and then move on. And I know that most places, they are putting up condos and apartment complexes. So we're thinking that that may be just what happens here.
Jones says the thought of leaving East Austin is bittersweet. But he thinks wherever the church moves, his congregation will follow. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
KUT WT's Audrey McGlinchey reported earlier this week about the iconic Harlem Theater in East Austin. It's just down the block from the intersection of 12th and Chacon Streets. That theater burned down back in 1973. And since then, it's just been a vacant lot for more than 40 years. The company that owns that lot owns nearly three dozen more properties on the street. So in order to tell the story, KUT's Audrey McGlinchey decided to take a walk.
One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. Oh, hey. I'm standing on the corner of East 12th and Curve Streets. I got on my walking shoes, really just a pretty beat up pair of Converse. The first address on my list is right here, 913 East 12th Street. It's a really overgrown vacant lot. There's no buildings on it. There's a ton of trees. Well, I got about 34 more properties to go, so let's get to it.
For Natasha Madison, unraveling the story meant starting with a question.
Who owns all these empty lots?
Madison's a member of the East 12th Street Merchants Association. It's a group organizing local businesses so they can have a say in the future of East 12th Street. Naturally, Madison wanted to know who owns pieces of it.
So we did a little digging around, and several we found out on our own were owned by Eureka.
Eureka Holdings, a development company based in Grapevine outside of Dallas. Let's break this down. Madison figured this out in the same way I did, Travis County Property Records. Except the question I started with was, who owns the vacant lot at 1800 East 12th Street, where the Harlem Theater once stood? It's a company called 2013 Austin East 12th Street, LP. My initial reaction was, well, that's a dumb name. It sounds like someone came up with it in a hurry. Long story short, because who wants to hear me talk about property records, the mailing address for that company? An address in Grapevine, Texas, which belongs to a development company called Eureka Holdings. And here's where Madison and I had to go deeper.
We weren't inclined to look for multiple LLC names.
It's not unusual for one company to hold property under various names, either because of certain tax benefits or in order to keep a low profile. And here's where things get entertaining. Some of these company names are, well, creative. 2101 East 12th Street, owned by Country Nelly CRLP. Oh. 1200 Walnut Street, just off of East 12th. Austin Danger Powers LP.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
Any South Park fans out there? 1500 East 12th Street is owned by Soda Sopa Salmon LP.
There's a certain quality to the vibe and energy that is Soda Sopa. From the independent merchants and unique cafes.
Ironically, that episode was poking fun at how gentrifying neighborhoods are marketed. All of these properties were purchased between 2013 and 2016, and the property value among them? Nearly $16 million. Raymond Medeiros sold Eureka one of their properties.
We had a couple of beers, and he told me not even listed. He'd just pay me whatever I wanted for it.
What he got was $430,000 for an empty corner lot on East 12th Street. Medeiros grew up in the home that once stood at the corner of East 12th and Curve Streets. He told me he got a call from Eureka a couple of years ago asking to meet with him. A few beers later, and the lot was sold to the company in 2015. Medeiros is now trying to buy a place in the country.
I'm old. I need to slow down. Lockhart has a nice little slow something.
Speaking of slow something, where's my walking self at? Hey there, so I just started back down the north side. I'm now at East 12th and Salina, right at the corner where the Harlem Theater once stood. A lot of these properties so far owned by Eureka Holdings are homes. There's a few businesses that lease from them, including a nonprofit, a barber shop, and a couple of vacant lots. So now I'm heading down the north side and we'll see what we've got on this side of the street. Back to you. Thanks, you. It all begs this question from Natasha Madison.
I did find myself wondering, what was the plan?
So I asked Eureka,
what was the plan for their 36 properties on East 12th Street? Vice President Stephen Gibson didn't want to be recorded, but he did respond to an email I sent, writing, quote, "There is no specific plan at this time." Eureka's met with the 12th Street Merchants Association, and Madison says they've been amicable, but she knows nothing about what they've got in mind for the street. As for what she'd like to see, for that we go to the neighborhood's past, a past where Black residents were forced to live on this side of town, and so East 12th Street had to serve all their needs.
African Americans weren't welcome outside of that community, so we did everything we needed to do within the confines of that community out of necessity. People in the district, they ate there, they went to school there, they shopped there, they buried their dead there. Everything that we did within this community.
A self-sufficient community is what Madison wants to see again, where going to East 12th Street meant grocery shopping, haircutting, and yes, even dead burying. A place where the young, the old, and the history move among one another. I asked Madison, is that something Eureka could build? She's hopeful.
But I would be remiss to say that it's a business, you know? Real estate development is big money, big business, and it is what it is. And at the end of the day, what it's about is, you know, being able to show ROI on a spreadsheet.
That's return on investment.
And that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is altruism. What I'm talking about is compassion. And some of that will mean that in an opportunity to take the money or provide for the community, you have to provide for the community.
In an email, I asked Gibson of Eureka why East 12th Street. He wrote, quote, "Location, availability, cost, zoning, permitting, commercial viability, financing. All these and more are factors that go into our decision making," end quote. Hey there. So I'm at the end of my journey. I'm now at the last property that Eureka Holdings owns on the north side of East 12th Street, 1000 East 12th Street. It's the end of a very long vacant block. So it remains to be seen what the company is going to do with these properties, if they intend to buy up more of East 12th Street or develop what they have. Here on East 12th and Curve Street, I'm Audrey McGlinchey for KUT News.
That is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of March 2017. Thank you so much for listening. And a reminder, you can find all the stories in our reporting project on 12th and Chacon at this website, onmyblockatx.org. That's onmyblockatx.org. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. And if you have any questions or comments, email me, nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,